Good evening. This is Rob McClure and Vicki Iden bringing you your local news live from the WORT studios on Bedford Street in beautiful downtown Madison. Here are the headlines for this evening.
Construction began Monday on the final mile of the 102-mile Cardinal Hickory Creek Power Transmission Line, which starts in Dubuque County, Iowa, and ends in Middleton, Wisconsin. If completed, the line would cross the Mississippi River National Wildlife and Fish Refuge near Cassville. Work was underway on Monday after utilities completed a land swap, which enabled the two companies to build on the Mississippi River Federal Wildlife Refuge. Wisconsin conservation groups opposed the transmission line and sued in March to block the land swap and the construction of the line. They contend laws were violated in approving the property exchange between the two utilities. Federal Judge William Conley had granted a temporary injunction to the project, but last week the U.S. Court of Appeals overturned the injunction, restarting the project. The utility companies said they expect work on tower foundations to begin May 27th. Most of the towers will be 75 feet tall at their tallest, except for one 200-foot tower.
State regulators tasked with administering Wisconsin's election laws are grappling with the best way to implement a constitutional amendment that was approved by voters last month. The amendment, which 58% of voters approved, stipulates that only election officials may administer elections. While that sounds straightforward, it could have broad consequences for the many outside contractors that routinely play a role in administering elections. For example, printing companies, which contract with election officials to print ballots. The Wisconsin Examiner reports that at a meeting today, the Wisconsin Election Commissions took the first steps to begin drafting guidance for election clerks. A formal rulemaking process could take longer than a year. Wisconsin's roughly 1,850 municipal elections clerks don't have a year to wait. The August primary is just 3 months away. The commission could take up the issue again tomorrow during another scheduled meeting. Then they're also slated to take up additional planning for the late summer primary and for two additional special elections announced by Governor Evers yesterday.
A case challenging the constitutionality of Act 10 is set to come before a Dane County judge later this month. Act 10, the state law that eliminated collective bargaining for most public sector workers, has been on the books in Wisconsin for more than a decade now. The signature policy from former Governor Scott Walker resulted in massive protests in downtown Madison in 2011, which, at their zenith, attracted as many as 100,000 people to the state capitol. The lawsuit was filed last fall by public employees and labor unions, including chapters of the Teamsters, Service Employees International Union, or SEIU, teachers' unions, and the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, or AFSCME, AFSCME. Oral arguments are scheduled for two Tuesdays from now on May 28th. The case could wind its way through the courts to end up at the state Supreme Court, which now has a liberal majority.
Wisconsin appears to be split on whether the state's flag should change, according to a solicitation for reader comments from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. The newspaper reports that it received hundreds of responses in just the past few days. Just under half say the state flag should stay the same, while 45% say it should change. The ask came after Minnesota unveiled its new flag last weekend. The modernized design features an abstract shape of Minnesota in dark blue with baby blue elsewhere and white eight-pointed star representing the North Star. It replaces a periwinkle flag with an intricate and some would say too complicated design at the center. And Wisconsin's flag is similar if you're trying to picture it. It's royal blue with the state coat of arms in the center. In white capital condensed Gothic letters, the word Wisconsin appears at the top. And at the bottom, it reads 1848, the year the state was admitted to the Union. And that design has changed little since it was established 161 years ago. The last change came in 1979 when the state legislature updated the flag with the state name and the statehood year. Debate over that change came with its own detractors who said the flag was already too cluttered. Madison's city flag, meanwhile, was updated in 2018.
Construction on a treatment facility to filter PFAS and other chemicals out of an east side well has begun. The Madison Water Utility broke ground today on a treatment facility for Madison's Well 15. That well has been out of commission for years. The Madison Water Utility shut it down in 2019 after it detected unusual amounts of the toxic forever chemicals. At the time, neither state nor federal standards for acceptable levels of PFAS in drinking water existed. Earlier this year, the federal EPA finalized regulations for PFAS in drinking water. Under those rules, water utilities will be required to monitor PFAS levels by 2027. The treatment facility is slated to be operational by the summer of 2025. It's the first municipal PFAS treatment facility in Wisconsin, reports Isthmus Newspaper. Meanwhile, state help for other municipalities across the state to clean up PFAS remains a political football. We'll have more on that in just a few minutes.
And those were the headlines. Now on to the rest of the day's top stories. For the next 6 months, the city of Monona won't allow any new vape shops to open for business, thanks to a change approved by city leaders last week. Monona city officials say they'll use the time to investigate how the shop's proximity to schools and parks impacts the public health and whether further regulation is needed. Our producer, Faye Parks, has the details.
Monona Alders unanimously approved a temporary freeze on approving any new vape shops last week after just about 20 minutes of discussion. The ordinance defines a vape shop as an establishment that dedicates 10% or more of its floor space to electronic smoking devices or related paraphernalia. By that definition, the city already counts three vape shops catering to Monona's population of 8,600 residents. Two of those shops are located on the city's main thoroughfare, Monona Drive.
Somebody referred to it as Vape Alley the other day.
Really?
The ordinance refers to that collection of vape shops as a proliferation. The moratorium means a pause on occupancy permits, planning approval, zoning permits, and building permits for any new electronic smoking retailer. It also gives code enforcement and police the authority to inspect existing retailers for enforcement. And it directs Monona's Plan Commission and Public Safety Committee to study the effects of vaping on the welfare of city residents and to issue any recommendations to address those effects. The pause comes after Monona's Plan Commission received a proposal for a fourth vape shop, also proposed for Monona Drive. The vacant storefront is just blocks from Monona's middle and high schools. In a letter, Monona Police Chief Brian Cheney asked city leaders to deny the permit, writing that the business would serve as a smoking advertisement students would see each day on their commute to school. The Plan Commission ultimately rejected the proposal, citing insufficient parking. But according to Monona City Attorney William Cole, the wave of new vape shops in the area inspired them to draft the ordinance, stopping the Plan Commission from accepting requests or issuing permits.
That would simply freeze the status quo to give us 180 days to look at the empirical data. You know, does it harm children? Is the proximity to schools, parks an issue? And if so, to bring forth proposed legislation to the council to address those issues.
According to the state's Department of Health Services, underage tobacco and vape sales are on the rise in Wisconsin by 140% since 2019. Monona Alders spoke in favor of the moratorium, pointing out that the city has few regulations in place to stop the flood of new vape shops or where they open. And Monona Alder Patrick DePula pointed out that there is some precedent for tighter regulations under state law.
Sounds to me like it's appropriate. We regulate how many liquor licenses we have in the city based upon, you know, our population.
Last year, the city of Milwaukee issued a similar moratorium and ultimately changed its zoning regulations to allow vape shops no less than 1,000 feet away from schools, reports the Wisconsin State Journal. Madison City Attorney Mike Haas told WORT Today that Madison City officials have not explored a similar moratorium. Monona's moratorium will expire early this November. Reporting for WORT News, I'm Faye Parks.
In a chaotic session yesterday, Senate Republicans used their supermajority to override nine of the governor's vetoes on bills ranging from post-election audits to PFAS contamination. But the vote was largely symbolic. The state assembly, in which Republicans hold a majority but are a couple of seats away from a supermajority, has not scheduled any override votes of its own. The Republican-authored PFAS bill passed along party lines earlier this year, with many conservation groups arguing that it protected polluters and not public health. Tony Wilkin-Gibart is the executive director of Midwest Environmental Advocates, a nonprofit law center that joined the outcry against the bill. He told WORT news producer Faye Parks this afternoon that while PFAS contamination is a serious issue, the governor was right to issue a veto.
Thank you for joining me, Tony.
Thanks for having me, Faye.
So for some background, can you tell us the health risks associated with PFAS contamination in water?
So PFAS are a class of man-made compounds that have been manufactured in the U.S. since the 1940s. They've been useful in a variety of products, including Teflon cookware, rain-repellent clothing, firefighting foam. But they have been shown, and the science is becoming increasingly clear, that even small amounts of PFAS are associated with very serious health conditions, including developmental and reproductive problems, certain types of cancer, decreased immune response. And we're still really in the process of learning the full extent of the health risks that are associated with increased exposure to PFAS.
And just how widespread is PFAS contamination in Wisconsin?
PFAS are called forever chemicals because they don't break down easily in the environment. That's what's made them useful in a lot of consumer and industrial applications. We could also call them everywhere chemicals because they are ubiquitous in the environment. They don't break down. They're concerning in small quantities. And so they can be found throughout Wisconsin and really throughout the globe. PFAS is even detected at the poles. We are most concerned about PFAS in drinking water supplies because exposure through drinking water is a predominant exposure pathway. And we know that there are concerning levels of PFAS at sites throughout Wisconsin. Currently, the DNR is investigating PFAS contamination at 140 different sites throughout the state. We're still learning more. As more testing is done, we will surely identify more sites of concern.
But earlier this year, Governor Evers vetoed a Republican-authored bill that would have dispensed $125 million in PFAS remediation funding to communities across the state. Since then, state Republicans have accused the governor of withholding much-needed relief, a sentiment they actually repeated in yesterday's veto override session. You and your organization actually encouraged the governor to strike down the bill, arguing that it would protect polluters. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. It's a shame that the process of appropriating funds to help communities in Wisconsin deal with PFAS has become so complicated and convoluted that it is a struggle for folks to understand exactly what is going on. But one important point is that the bill that was vetoed did not appropriate any funding whatsoever. It created grant programs that could be the vehicle for a separate pot of funding to be used and spent. However, this legislation did not direct or require that that money be released. In addition to creating grant programs, the legislation restricted the state's ability to hold PFAS polluters accountable. And just to explain why the legislature would pass a bill that is marketed as a PFAS funding bill but did not appropriate any money, that's because the Wisconsin Constitution allows the governor to line item veto appropriations bills. And that provision is in the Constitution so that the legislature can't attach riders to appropriation bills, to sneak policy that the governor doesn't approve of in appropriations bills. And the attempt to circumvent that is why we're in this situation in the first place, because the authors of the bill want to limit the state's ability to hold PFAS polluters accountable. We can talk about exactly how the bill does that, but I think it's important for folks just to realize that we're well outside of the normal and traditional appropriations process, and we're outside that process because there is this ulterior motive to change the authority that the state has to hold PFAS polluters accountable.
Yeah, I'd love to hear more about that, how exactly it would prevent accountability.
There are two main reasons. The first has to do with how the bill defines an innocent landowner. And in general terms, the bill would prevent the state from taking enforcement action against a, quote, innocent landowner or an entity that is eligible for an innocent landowner grant. But the definition of an innocent landowner under the legislation was drafted so broadly that it would apply to paper mills and industrial waste dischargers that spread PFAS on farm fields as a means of waste disposal. That provision was put forward to supposedly protect farmers and others that accepted these biosolids that contained PFAS, but it was drafted so broadly that it would not only potentially protect farmers and actual innocent landowners, but it would also protect the companies and the PFAS polluters that spread those biosolids, which would then leave the state and the communities in Wisconsin with less tools to hold the actual responsible parties, the polluters, the companies that profited from and spread PFAS throughout the environment, accountable for the damage that they caused. So that's one reason. But a second provision of the bill applies more broadly than even that provision. It, under the language of the bill, applies to entities that are not innocent landowners, and it would prevent the state from enforcing the spills law, or the main law that we have to hold PFAS polluters accountable. It would prevent the state from enforcing the spills law against anyone unless and until the state promulgates rules that set numeric standards for PFAS contamination. And the problem there is that the state has, for a number of years, been trying to promulgate those rules, promulgate those standards, but it's actually Senate Republicans that have stood in the way and prevented the state from promulgating those rules. The impact of that provision in the bill is that if the governor had signed it, the state would no longer be able to commence any enforcement actions against PFAS polluters under a law that's been on the books for over 45 years on day one of signing that bill. That was simply unacceptable. It should never have been tucked into a bill that is supposed to provide relief to Wisconsin communities, and the authors of the legislation should never have tried to force the governor and others to choose between spending the taxpayers' money to where it's needed to help communities deal with PFAS contamination on the one hand, and on the other, letting PFAS polluters off the hook.
So before I let you go, is there anything else you'd like to add?
The costs of dealing with PFAS contamination in Wisconsin are going to extend well into the hundreds of millions, if not billions. This legislation was billed as providing a means to spend about $125 million. While that is a significant amount of money, it is not nearly enough to deal with the full extent of the issue. And if we are then, when we're distributing that money, tying the state's hands and holding PFAS polluters accountable, that is a bad deal because there will then be less financial resources to bring to bear in Wisconsin communities like Town of Stella, like Marinette, like French Island, where we're going to need both taxpayer dollars, but we're also going to need polluters to pay their fair share as well.
Thank you again for agreeing to speak with me, Tony.
Okay, thanks a lot, Faye.
That was Tony Wilkin Gibbart, the Executive Director of Midwest Environmental Advocates, a nonprofit legal firm.
Prescribed burning can reduce wildfire damage. The low-intensity fires help clear dead wood and vegetation, reducing the fuel available when a wildfire comes along. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz of Yale's Climate Connections has more.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. In 2020, the Cameron Peak Fire raged across more than 200,000 acres of Colorado. But the damage could have been more severe if not for how government agencies and landowners had managed some forested land before the fire. In some areas, they had conducted prescribed burns, intentional fires that are carefully monitored and managed.
When I interviewed land managers, they said where they had done prescribed fire, they were able to hold that wildfire because it came in and it would kind of settle down and they were able to manage it more effectively.
Courtney Schultz of Colorado State University says prescribed burns are planned for times when it's not too hot, windy, or dry, so they're more easily controlled. The low-intensity fire helps clear out dead wood and vegetation. So if a wildfire later sweeps through, there's less fuel to feed the flames. As the climate warms, forested areas that have not burned for generations are more vulnerable to dangerous blazes.
Fuel accumulates, and now when fires burn, it's burning under the hottest, driest conditions. We're seeing bigger, hotter, more extensive, more severe fires than ever.
So the careful use of beneficial fire can help reduce the risk of these devastating infernos. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
The time is now 6:32, and you're listening to the live local news on WORT. I'm your host, Robert McClure, here with my co-host, Vicki Iden. Thanks for joining us.
911 dispatchers are first in line to respond to an emergency call or text. In this public safety career, prioritizing tasks and staying focused in overwhelming moments is crucial. On this week's Madison's Backbone, Tom, a seasoned 911 dispatcher, tells feature contributor Riley Cutright exactly what happens after his phone rings on the job.
A community is a unified body of individuals sharing something in common. Over a quarter of a million people call Madison, Wisconsin their home. Have you ever wondered about the secret to Madison's vibrant and unique community? Well, I have the answer for you. Workers. This segment features the working voices who undeniably strengthen and brighten Madison's community on the daily. I'm Riley Cutright, and this is Madison's Backbone. Hi, everyone. Thanks for tuning into Madison's Backbone. I'm here with Tom.
I work in public safety as a 911 dispatcher. Work for the city of Middleton.
How did you get your start as a 911 dispatcher?
Well, it was almost on a whim. I had a job, a college job, working for a school district, and I would repair audiovisual equipment. And the local EMS in my small town was having a CPR course in the school, and I just happened to stumble across it. And I was talking to the EMT who was teaching the course, the CPR instructor, and said, gee, I've always wanted to take one of these. And she said, well, why don't you take it tonight? And I couldn't think of any reason not to, so I came back after work and did the CPR course. And she was very professional, and she was confident because she was a lifesaver, and I thought that was really cool. And she had all these interesting gadgets with her, and this was in the days before cell phones and computers. She had a walkie-talkie that she could talk to other people on, and she had a pager that she could get her calls on. And I was a fix-it type of guy, so I was really intrigued by all of that. And I became an EMS volunteer at her encouragement, and that led to other things. I got a summer job with the Madison Police Department, an intern job, and eventually that led to a dispatching job for the Madison Fire Department. This was in the days before 911, so you actually had to look in your phone book, and that's another foreign term for people these days. Nobody has phone books anymore, but when we had phone books, on the front inside cover, there was a whole list of phone numbers, and you had to know where you lived, and you had to call a 7-digit number for help. And Madison Police was one, Madison Fire, Dane County Sheriff. So I worked for the Madison Fire Department, which had their own dispatch center prior to 911 when everything was consolidated. That actually led to a firefighting career. But I also, all that time, I enjoyed dispatching, even though I was a firefighter. So I saw an ad for the city of Middleton. They were hiring part-time dispatchers. And I did that, got that job. Eventually retired from Madison Fire Department, but all that time, all those years, I kept my part-time Middleton police dispatch job, and I'm still doing it today.
What do you do in your work day?
So my shift is 8 hours, and I answer phones, obviously, and the phones can be 7-digit non-emergency general questions or 911 calls. We also take text, and you can text our 7-digit number, or you can actually now, just recently this came into being, you can text 911. So I get input or calls or information from all those sources. We also have a lobby counter so people can come into the police department and talk directly to me. Officers will come in or detectives and they might need information or data run or they're doing an investigation and I'll need to check databases for them. So I'm juggling all these balls in the air and I have to prioritize what's more important at that particular instant. The calls can be callers can be very calm or they can be very hysterical. And there doesn't seem to be any rhyme or reason between that and the actual level of severity of the call. Sometimes the people are screaming and yelling about the silliest little thing, and then the next call could be a major emergency, and they're very calm and collected.
Okay, yeah, I was wondering about that. So are you usually working by yourself?
In my dispatch center, yes, and that's the case with most of the public safety answering points across the country. Here in Madison, in Dane County, there is one central 911 center with multiple operators, but there are still a few satellite centers like mine where I'm working by myself, or very occasionally we have a second position. We have office people trained to answer phones, so if something happens, we can ramp up pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, I'm mostly, when I'm working, I'm all by myself. It is a stressful job, and you have to realize that at some point you're going to be overwhelmed, and you just have to prioritize. I might have to put my hand up to that person at the window and say, I'll be with you in just a minute, I'm talking on 911.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the challenging part of the job, but it's also an interesting part. It's a fun part, actually.
What is the most difficult part about your job?
With the pandemic, there have always been mentally ill people in our community, but the pandemic and the isolation destabilized a lot more of them. And it seems like we get more and more calls, more than I remember in my previous early years of my career. Keeping them calm and on point and getting down to the reason why they called and how we can best help them is probably the most challenging part of my job, especially today. It's actually a shift. It's been a noticeable shift. We all, officers and dispatchers, have mental health training to help us deal with these types of callers, trying to keep someone focused and get to the reason why they're calling and sort through the reality from the imaginations or the things that aren't real. It's very time-consuming and challenging. On my typical eight-hour shift, I take at least one or two calls that are like this. And there's an 80-20 rule that 80% of the resources are spent on 20% of the people. So a lot of these people call multiple times. So you get to know them, you know their address even before they start talking or who they are, which is actually helpful because we know from past experience where the conversation's likely to go.
What is your favorite part about your job?
Probably the fact that I'm in public safety. There are various responders, police, fire, ambulance. They're called first responders. And I am the first responder. I'm the tip of the spear. So everything starts with the dispatcher. When you call 911 or even when you call the 7-digit non-emergency number, if you don't have an emergency, it all starts with me or my colleagues. We are not the first person that you see. We're the first person that you talk to. We're not thought of as the first entry into the emergency system, but we are. And I can give them useful information. I can give them helpful information and direct them to, by asking specific questions, get to what needs to be done next and get an idea for what resources I have to send. So it's a very responsible job.
Mm-hmm.
So that's stressful. Not wanting to make a mistake, although the police officers, firefighters, EMTs, if they need more help than I'm sending, they're going to let me know and I'll ramp up the call.
Mm-hmm.
But I try to do a good job of judging it and sending the proper response. And that's a balancing act, too. You can't just send the whole world to everything.
Yeah.
Because there are multiple calls and you have to be cognizant that other officers need to be available for the call that's going to come in 2 minutes or 10 minutes from now. Everything is scalable, so it's all pre-planned. So we know if we have more calls than we have officers, there are mutual aid agreements. So Madison will come into Middleton, Dane County Sheriff will come into Middleton, and we'll do the same for them. So if there's a hot spot of activity that requires more police officers than that town or that jurisdiction has, the other surrounding jurisdictions will automatically or in a pre-planned way escalate and come in to help us. This all started with fire. Police got on onto this idea late in the game, but fire for many years has had a first alarm, second alarm, escalating a pre-planned order of response where things are the number of trucks or engines sent is scaled to the size of the incident. I like having some control over that and some say-so. Maybe the protocol will dictate that I should send this, but I know from talking to the caller that it really requires that.
Thanks for tuning in to Madison's Backbone. We'll see you again in 2 weeks for more 911 dispatcher information with Tom.
And it's time now for the most comprehensive weather report on the airwaves with WORT weather guru, Rob McClure.
Well, despite rather cooler temperatures yesterday than we were anticipating, that was due to Monday's weather system kind of dawdling to our southeast and keeping us cloudy most of the day, we nevertheless did post an average temperature 1 degree above normal. So that makes the first half of May a sweep, basically. Every single day was above normal, so far anyway. And that leaves us with a temperature surplus of 5.1 degrees for May. So it is looking like this will be our 14th month in a row above normal. There's certainly no indication of anything getting in the way of that in the coming several days, with a split flow pattern in the upper air above the North American continent and generally zonal or west-to-east momentum in each of those two jet branches north and south of us. It appears that the next 5 or 6 days anyway will see no concerns at all for any significant cold air intrusion, at least anywhere across the upper Midwest. The high-pressure cells, the air masses that will be coming in and occasionally veering our winds northerly, first briefly on Friday and then again on Sunday, those air masses will generally have been directed eastward into here off the Pacific Ocean, so it'll be fairly mild, and their front-side winds will not have any access to the colder air that does still lie up to our north, up in central Canada. And otherwise, over coming days, low-pressure circulations passing along that northern branch of the jet will generally keep us bathed in southerly winds from now out through Monday or perhaps even Tuesday. Have a look at the water vapor image of North America that we have linked on the WORT weather webpage this evening, and you'll get a pretty clear view of the two jet stream tracks I was referring to. One from about central Baja California across Texas and then the northern Gulf of Mexico, and the other up to our north. A bit more disjointed, that one, with a number of low pressure whirls and some small waves of various sizes passing through it. It's generally coursing, though, across the Canadian border region. Of particular note for us on that image, in at least the near term, is the little gyre that's visible in northeastern Nebraska, which will be lifting northeastward into northern Minnesota tomorrow, and will swing a cold front through here after otherwise warming us and moistening the atmosphere with its lead-side southerly winds. If you're looking at that feature, you can probably tell it's not particularly vigorous or large. So the temperature and moisture swings won't be terribly noticeable, but you probably will notice the uptick in the moisture content in the air, the dew point tomorrow, up into the upper 50s, after warm frontal showers cross the area in the morning hours. And we will have enough of a potential energy increase from that added moisture to perhaps produce a few strong thunderstorms in the afternoon ahead of the incoming cold front. That front's also not going to be particularly vigorous, but it will veer our winds northwesterly for at least the first part of Friday, and winds will be backing then lightly south or southeast again, probably even by Friday evening, and produce a more summer-like day for Saturday. Even Friday will be much warmer than tomorrow, I think. That'll be ahead of a much stronger low-pressure circulation, which will be associated with a speed maximum and a dip in the jet stream that you can see just approaching the central British Columbia coast off the Pacific Ocean, if you're looking at the water vapor. That the longer-range forecast models take that system to our north from the Dakotas up into northern Manitoba by Sunday. So the cold front that it's going to unspool in this direction may mostly be just a surface feature as it comes through here without a lot of upper lift associated with it. So the late-day thunderstorms that may occur Saturday may be pretty widely scattered and perhaps concentrated mostly to the north part of the listening area. And Sunday and Monday then look similarly warm behind the cold front, given the mild air mass that'll be coming in. But back to the tonight, briefly, for the details. Skies will see increasing high and mid-level clouds going forward, but no real thickening overcast, I don't think, until sometime tomorrow morning. Temperatures will drop to the low 50s overnight on light east to southeast winds at 3 to 6 miles per hour. And tomorrow, passing showers will start to work northeastward into the area, probably by the mid-morning sometime or late morning, somewhat scattered coming through, probably with a break, I think, then in the midday or early afternoon hours. Temperatures will reach 70 or so, with dew points increasing from the low 40s at the beginning of the day to the upper 50s by, say, mid-afternoon. On southeasterly winds, which will be veering southwesterly at 5 to 10 miles per hour, showers and thunderstorms are then again likely in the mid to late afternoon hours, and again, perhaps with a few stronger cells getting going. Precipitation should end then in the evening hours with some clearing later on and a low temperature in the mid-50s. Winds will veer lightly west and northwest overnight. And Friday should be generally clear with winds backing lightly southeast again through the daytime hours and a high temperature in the mid to upper 70s. Winds will begin to veer more southerly, still quite light as we go overnight with a low temperature in the upper 50s. And Saturday will be a bit breezier with winds veering more southwesterly at 5 to 10 miles per hour and helping us achieve a high temperature around 80. Dew points will return to the mid or upper 50s, and late afternoon showers and thunderstorms are likely to swing through from and perhaps in a line from the northwest, probably with better coverage and more vigor the farther north you are. Winds will be veering northwesterly overnight, and temperatures will return to the upper 70s again on Sunday. At the moment at the station down here on Bedford Street, the temperature is 69 degrees. The dew point temperature is 48. Winds are out of the east at 5 miles per hour, generally clear over the station, but with a fair bit of passing cirrus. And the barometer's at 29.85 inches of mercury and falling slowly.
We go now to May 17th, 1967, when Madison had a unique protest against a wrong-way bus lane. Stu Levitan has the details about no rapid transit on tonight's Madison in the 60s.
They melt into a dream.
Madison in the 60s, May 1967. In a year when many campuses have demonstrations against the war, the draft, and the CIA, only Madison has a disruptive protest over a wrong-way bus lane. When the reconstructed University Avenue opened in November 1966, the entire university community warned that having one eastbound lane for buses running against the four westbound lanes was dangerous, especially since several intersections did not have traffic lights. Their worst fears were realized on March 1, 1967, when campus beauty queen Donna Schuler walked into the side of a bus and was injured so badly her left leg had to be amputated. Everyone from student government to the regents pleaded with the city to move the bus lane over to the newly expanded one-way eastbound Johnson Street. But the city refused. The protest is planned by computer science professor Leonard Ur on behalf of the Committee to Save the Bus Lane for Bicycles. It's to be a lawful demonstration, with students massed at the intersections of University Avenue and Brooks and Charter Streets, where the lack of traffic light give the pedestrians the right of way. When a bus approaches, they'll pack the crosswalk. The demonstration begins as planned at 3 p.m. on May 17th, with Professor Ur and a few hundred students walking west on the University Avenue sidewalks, crossing slowly at every intersection to hold up traffic. But then an advance squad breaks away and encounters an eastbound bus at Brook Street, chanting, "Illegal and immoral! Illegal and immoral!" Several students spontaneously drop their bikes to block the bus and get on the ground themselves. Hundreds of reinforcements rush up in support, both on their feet and on the ground. Forcibly clearing a path for the bus to escape, police arrest 15, including the leading campus protester, Bob Cohen. The crowd of participants and supportive observers is now about 3,000. For the next 3 hours, students use their bodies and their bicycles to block the buses. When the buses reroute to Johnson Street, students follow, and back again. Police make 25 arrests, including Cohen, for a second time, and law student Paul Soglin, who had just resigned as a member of the WSA Student Senate. Some are arrested for blocking buses, some for cursing out the cops. A half dozen are arrested after a group of 300 surrounds a squad car and accosts the officer inside. Most end up paying small fines. Late that night, an entirely unaffiliated group of about 300 boisterous young men stage a combination panty raid march to the Capitol. They rock a city bus, break a window, and block University Avenue. There are no arrests. On Thursday, May 18th, the City Traffic Commission votes unanimously to continue the bus lane with new safeguards, 2 more traffic lights, a wider walkway, and a barrier to prevent mid-block crossing. Madison Bus Company President William Staub, a voting member of the commission, does not participate in the discussion or decision. Unfortunately for the political demonstrators, another panty raid and water fight Thursday night grows into the biggest campus disorder in several years. Police make 6 arrests as they battle up to 2,500 students who smash lights on State Street in the state capitol, invade women's dorms, and disrupt traffic throughout downtown. Although this second disturbance is entirely unrelated to the bus demonstration, neither the public nor politicians make any distinction. When the bus-based demonstrations and disruptions continue Friday morning, Teamster union officials order the bus drivers not to drive through campus, and the company routes buses down Regent Street instead. At about 2:30 in the afternoon, with chaos still raging, they stop driving all routes. A complete shutdown of all bus service throughout the city until Saturday morning, when cops on every corner restore order. "The people of the city are furious at the university," says Mayor Otto Feske. The Common Council certainly is, unanimously adopting resolutions that the university, quote, "take direct disciplinary action with respect to students who deliberately and flagrantly violate state law and city ordinances, and reimburse the city $2,700 for special police services." Reflecting the growing political threat from the legislature, the state assembly jumps in, voting 86-9 for a harshly worded resolution condemning both students and the administration. And at least one powerful regent wants the administration to find, quote, "some way to reprimand Professor for his activism." Quote, "While we may not have the legal right to discipline," says Regent Dr. James Nellen, team physician for the Green Bay Packers, quote, "we have the moral right to do so." "A completely shocking concept," replies Regent Arthur DeBartle-Baden, an attorney from Park Falls. Feske says police will, quote, "crack their heads together," close quote, if necessary to restore order, and demands the university, quote, "obtain copies of the police arrest reports and call these students in for discipline." Chancellor Robin Fleming, who has already announced he's leaving to become president of the University of Michigan, says he will neither discipline students for non-academic offenses nor crack their heads. A week later, the council votes to retain the bus lane and implement the commission's safety recommendations. In June, 7 months after the wrong-way bus lane opened, the city installs traffic lights at Charter and Brook Street. And on the weekend of May 12th and 13th, Quixote Literary Journal jumpstarts the Summer of Love. On Saturday, Journal founders Morris and Betsy Edelson bring Allen Ginsberg and the Fugs to the Stock Pavilion, where they entrance and excite a near-capacity crowd of 1,700 with Third Coast Sutra. It's an evening of profane and profound beat poetry and avant-garde rock. Ginsberg reads Kral Mayales, King of May, his ode to Beatlemania, Portland Coliseum and First Party at Ken Kesey's with Hell's Angels. And the Fugs perform Slum Goddess of the Lower East Side and Wet Dream Over You. The next day, a chanting Ginsberg dressed in white, the Fugs, and a crowd of hundreds venture to Picnic Point to dance, sing, eat, love, and get high at Madison's most successful be-in of the season. It's sponsored by Quixote, the Wisconsin Film Society, and Zach Burke's Open Arts Group. And here's what Roundy says in the State Journal of May 25th. Quote, Bobby Hines showed the old-time university boxing pictures the other day. I want to see them again. When boxing was at Wisconsin, you didn't see no demonstrations then. And that's this week's Madison in the 60s. For your award-winning, listener-sponsored WORT News Team, I'm Stu Levitan.
And that does it for our show this evening. Thanks for listening to WORT's live local news at 6. And remember, we are looking for a receptionist on Wednesday evening, so if you're interested in coming down and spending a few hours at the station, we'd love to have you. It's a good bit of fun. Get in contact with the station during business hours. Our headline writer this evening was Greg Sanderson. Special thanks to our feature contributors Riley Cutright, Stu Levitan, and Dr. Anthony Weisowitz. Katie Gergella is our on-air engineer on Wednesdays. Faye Parks produced the newscast, and Shelley Pittman is the news director at WORT. I'm your host, Robert McClure.
And I'm your host, Vicki Iden. Stay up to date with the WORT Local News Podcast. Subscribe on iTunes Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever else you get your podcasts. Up next is Query, followed by This Way Out. Good night.